Howdy, howdy. You are tuned into another episode of Pacific Underground, the show that still needs a tagline, but basically is, hey, APIs, talking to APIs for APIs, doing the API thing.
I always take the tags off of my clothes anyway.
Yeah, just toss them to the side.
Who needs a tagline?
Who needs labels? Who needs labels? Okay, so we're just going to get right into it. Today, we are going to be featuring an interview with Nadio Okamoto, who grew up in Portland, and she recently had a piece published on nextchart.com that was called Until 3 Months Ago, I Was Ashamed of Being Asian. And I think for a lot of Asian Americans, like, you don't almost need to read the whole article to just immediately go like, oh yeah, I know what that's all about. I know, because a lot of people have their own story. And so I immediately just like really like it jumped out to me because I have such a story in my own head about that myself. And so I called her up and said, hey, let's talk about some more. And so she, if you've heard her name before, Nadio Okamoto is the founder I got too many things going in my head because Nadia is a really accomplished person. Nadia is the co-founder and director of the nonprofit organization Period, which you can learn more about at period.org. And Period is a nonprofit that was started here in Portland, Oregon, while she was in high school. And they provide menstrual products to people who need them. And they offer education around the need for menstrual products and the need for that discussion. Now she is living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, while she is going to school, and she recently ran for city council there, which is why she actually kind of came up with having to be faced with her own identity, because, hey, when you run for city council, it's a very public thing. And guess what? When you're Asian and you run for city council, everybody has to point that out to you and you have to suddenly defend it. So that's how she got inspired to publish this piece. So we're going to hear an interview. And then after that, the Pacific Underground crew, who I'm joined with right now, we're going to share our own stories and our own sort of thoughts. And so I'm joined with Jake and Tabitha and Kanan. Everyone say hello.
What's up?
Good morning.
Yeah, so let's just get right into the interview with Nadio Okamoto.
Like, when you first read it, people are like, what do you mean you were ashamed of being Asian until 3 months ago? Like, what changed? But I really mean it. Like, it was very sudden, and I think that I didn't realize how ashamed I was of, you know, where I come from and what I look like until I started realizing how good it felt to embrace it, you know? And I think growing up in a city, I mean, I grew up in New York and then Portland, Oregon, to grow up in these very liberal bubble cities where I think the people who live here very much pride themselves in not being racist, and being a very inclusive community, but like an all-white inclusive community, it's hard to recognize the behavior I grew up with and be like, oh, I did go through these phases where people were actively being racist. So I think I didn't realize the severity of it until I slowly realized how different it was to feel excited about who I am and what I look like.
When it comes to this identity issue in terms of, you know, how you're viewing yourself, you know, you mentioned this in your article, how, you know, when you came here, you were in fourth grade.
Yes, and I moved to Lake Oswego.
Oh goodness!
I know.
What so, like, did you recognize that, even though you were so young? Did you see like, oh wow, New York was this one way, and then wow, Portland is really different? Or were you too young to like notice the lack of diversity?
I could definitely notice it, and I was so angry. Like, my mom and I sort of joke about it, but I remember I moved to Oregon, right? And I mean, when you grow up in New York City, especially in Manhattan, you kind of build up this mentality of New York City being like the best city in the world, the center of the universe, right? Like, that's kind of what they preach to you even in school. And so, I mean, I remember moving to Oregon and being like, what are all these trees? And suddenly my mom was like, let's see who can spot the next minority that's not us in the restaurant, and like people asking me if I was related to like the one other Asian person.
Was that just weird for you? Was it just culture shock? Like, did you feel defensive, or did you feel confused because you were so young? Like, how did that internalize for you?
I mean, I don't know if I was very reflective about it in the past, but I think that I grew up for a little while in New York, I was living like in almost in Chinatown, like on Canal Street, and like my bus was full of students of color, right? And I think to go from that suddenly to a school where I was like one of two Asian kids in my class, and my teachers would openly say things like, oh, your parents must be so proud of you when I would get a math score, or like, don't be afraid of your parents, you must get so much pressure, like just sort of the assumptions of like how my parents taught me. I think those were all very new experiences for me. At the same time though, I think it was interesting to be around other, like a community that was scared to talk about or acknowledge race, right? Because it wasn't that I had never experienced racism in my life. I mean, growing up in New York, where you walk down the street and people are very forward with like saying things at you, whether that's catcalling or, you know, I remember walking down the streets and be like, oh, Chinese person, but like people are open about it, right? Mm-hmm. And like when I would be called a chink in elementary school in New York, people were very forward about it, right? Like oftentimes the other kids from Chinatown would call me a chink, right? But all of a sudden, like coming to like Oswego, it was like, you don't talk about race unless it's a very careful, like, it's a very careful, like, do you know this other person? Like referring to the one other Asian person. So I think that was definitely a culture shock for me.
Yeah, that passive aggressive Pacific Northwest attitude is something I'm still trying to get used to. Yeah, like asking me if I knew the other Asian person and just all these little really subtle things that at first felt so innocent and just kind of like nice, but then they keep coming. And it just made me realize like, oh, wow, this place is progressive and it views itself as progressive, but it's also like passively racist in it. I don't know if it realizes it.
Well, and I think that like it's dangerous because it perpetuates racism, but like in a way that makes you feel ashamed to speak out about it, right? Because I think it's in a way of like, you don't realize that it's happening until you're like, wow, no one wants to acknowledge that I'm a different race, right? Mm-hmm. Like no one is talking about it. Like it's sort of this like, let's not talk about race, right? Because we view you as equal and like we're not like, this is a dangerous subject, right? And so suddenly it's like, you don't, like I think I found myself in these situations where I was avoiding even identifying as an Asian American, right? I was like, I'm, you know, now in Lake Oswego, I'm from here, and like I don't, like I'm not connected to my grandparents or anything like that. So I think it was always really interesting for me. But I mean, moving to Oregon was tough too, because when I was in New York, I grew up around my grandparents, my dad's grandparents, who I was really close with. And then we moved out to Oregon where we had no family, like lost connection with our grandparents for a little while. But it was hard because until 2 years ago, I was actually living a third of the year almost in New York, because my dad still lives there today. I lost contact with my dad a few years ago because of some more details coming out about growing up with child and sex abuse that I just didn't recognize because I grew up with it. And I think when you grow up with abuse, it's just so normalized. It's like an everyday understanding of what that relationship is like. But until then, like my grandparents and my dad, who is an immigrant from Japan, were a very regular part of my life, right? And I think that it's interesting to know that when I lost contact with them, only then was I able to explore my own Asian identity. Because as I write about in my article, like, I think people look at me and they're like, you're Chinese, right? Like, you're, like, they just see me and, like, my face and they're like, you must be Chinese, or just, like, the overall category of Asian. But, like, there's actually a lot of racial tension in my family of being, like, half Chinese and half Japanese, right? And like kind of the animosity between the two races. And I think I needed the distance between my grandparents and like the racist ideas that that side of my family holds to be able to kind of explore what it means to be Asian American for myself.
You know, you're saying that, you know, there's like this animosity. So was there a tension that you experienced? You kind of talked about a little bit in your article. Could you maybe go talk about like, what were those things that you heard in your own home that made you feel that tension?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, so it's interesting because it's not really, it was never like a fight in my family, right? But it was always like very underhanded comments. Like I mean, my Taiwanese grandparents grew up in houses that were occupied by Japanese soldiers, right? And I remember like growing up, my mom would tell me how like her parents really didn't like that she was marrying and having a child with my dad at the age of like 21, 22. And part of that was because he's Japanese. And there's sort of this like you know, I think underlying hatred for the Japanese from where my grandparents are from. And so I think that there was a lot of that. But it was more vocalized on my Japanese side of the family, who we would walk around Chinatown in New York City and they would hold their noses and kind of look around in a very cautious way. And and my grandmother would openly say things like, "Oh, these people are so dirty. Like, let's get out of here." Like, it was a very like, "Don't touch me" sort of thing. And when we would walk into the house just to visit my grandparents, my grandmother would actually rush us to like give us baths or wash our hands and say these sort of things like, "Oh, I'm washing the Chinese off of you. Like, gotta wash the dirty Chinese off of you." Like, things like that. Or like if we came back from soccer practice and we were like a little bit sweaty and a little dirty, like she would say things like, you know, this is not your Japanese side, you know? Like, I think that there was a lot around hygiene and cleanliness and how that relayed to like the status and orientation of being Chinese, right? And so I think that it was always really hard for me to, you know, be in that environment and be like, is there anything good about being Chinese? And then in my other environment being like, can I be a kind and moral person if I'm Japanese? And like what that means to me.
And then you move to Portland and then you're having to have just your Asian-ness in general being otherized and thrown in your face, like in a public space that.
Oh, yeah.
That must have like caused so much. I don't know. What do you feel like it? How did that influence you growing up? Do you feel like it caused a confusion, or do you feel like, because I kind of wondered this in reading your article, was it like a shutdown for yourself in terms of like how you viewed yourself? Like, because one thing I really like that you said in your next Shark piece is where you talk about how you would where you'd put on your makeup every day to like make your eyes like look different, like to make yourself look less Asian, but you ended up just looking like a raccoon. Now when you're looking at yourself, you're like, wow, was that like a shutdown? Like, did you really think when you put on that makeup, did you see a less Asian person looking back at you in the mirror?
Absolutely. So, I mean, okay, so that started in middle school, right? Like, I remember sixth grade, I started wearing a lot of makeup. I started dressing like with more minimal clothing, like more skin showing, because like you know how they're like the Asian students who, you know, who immigrated in elementary school, and I think that they had a very standard way of wearing like Abercrombie and very name brand clothes. Mm-hmm. And I remember they would dress a little bit more conservatively.
Yeah.
And so I would see that and actively try to do the exact opposite. So I mean, my family wasn't very financially well off at that time. Like, we were living above and then kind of fluctuating under the poverty line. And so, like, I remember just my dream every Christmas and holiday was, like, to get a Juicy jacket and Uggs, because that's what, like, the rich white girls wore, right? And if not, then I was wearing, like, booty shorts and getting sent to the principal's office because I, like, that was against the dress code. And like just trying to wear like anything that made me vastly different from the people I knew I was associated with because I looked Asian, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the makeup really started in sixth and seventh grade, and I would put on eyeliner. Like, I would literally stress out about getting up in the morning and not go. I would like wait to get my makeup done until I went to school. I look back at my school photos and I just laugh because I just look so insecure and like a raccoon, you know, because I was putting my eyeliner like up and up and up thinking like, oh, this makes my eyes bigger. But it really just hid my eyes. So it's kind of funny. But it started because I remember fifth grade. So after fourth grade of living in Lake Oswego, I moved to Chapman Elementary in Northwest Portland, where I think students were, it was a little bit more diverse, but people were more forward about race. And so I started getting bullied a lot, by kind of like the popular guys of the class. And I would get bullied a lot, like about with like little rhymes about like Japanese, Chinese, like along with a little dance where they make their eyes squinty, or, you know, saying things like, oh, it smells like fish because like Nadia's vagina is Asian and things like that. Right. And like running away, or people telling me that they're going to hide their dogs because my family's going to eat it with chopsticks and things like that. And I think that going suddenly being thrown into this, like where that was an everyday part of life in fifth grade, made it so that when I transitioned to sixth grade, I was like, the solution is to just try to convince everyone that I'm not Asian, right? And then when people would make fun of me for being Asian, I would sort of play along with it of like, oh yeah, like, of course all Asians are like that. Well, thank goodness I'm not like that, right? And I think that was sort of my coping mechanism. And I mean, it sort of like breaks my heart because, I mean, just like you're saying, like how you, the article resonated with you because you also had some experiences like that. That's a lot of the feedback I'm getting, are these messages from so many people all around the country, and especially my friends who are like, me too. Like, I went through the same thing. I had the same feelings. And I think it's crazy to me to realize that, like, when I was going through that, I just felt so vastly alone, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, going through that, I was just like, does, like, I'm the only one who feels like this. I just wish I wasn't Asian. Like, I hate this. Like, no one understands me. I can't talk to anyone about how I feel about this. But then to realize that this is such a common thing, and I think that that's just a testament to the fact that that racism exists, right? And that, like, I have been asked a lot about the model minority idea, and I think that that very much is a thing. And I recognized that in my article a little bit, of this idea of, like, I think it was hard for me as, like, I grew up in a family that was very, like, my mom's a total social justice warrior. Like, we talked about race, and my sister's a Black Lives Matter activist through art, and we talk a lot about racial justice in America, like, over the dinner table. And I remember we would talk a lot about, you know, racism against African Americans in America, and how, like, the stereotypes that Asians are dealing with are just so vastly different in a way that it becomes very confusing, right? Because I remember coming home from school being like so upset by what people were saying to me, but then also realizing like they're making fun of me for being an overachiever, and they're making fun of me for doing well on this math test, and they're making fun of me because they think my parents care about my education, and they're making fun of me because they think I'm going to go to Harvard, right? And then to be like, but they're also not saying that I'm uneducated, and they're not saying that, you know, they're not calling me different names because of like anything necessarily bad. Like, it was very confusing to me, and I think my coping mechanism was just to like deny that I was Asian.
So if you were, you know, just until 3 months ago, if you were ashamed of, you know, identifying as Asian American, I'm curious. So in your article, you mentioned how this past summer you attended the Asian Pacific American Institute for Congressional Studies Gala. What inspired you then to go to that gala if you yourself weren't completely comfortable with identifying as Asian?
Yeah, so I went because I was running for office, right? I was running for Cambridge City Council for local government and in college, and I actually wanted to go because I wanted to meet more candidates, you know? Running for office is literally one of the most like exhausting and terrifying things I've ever done. just because I think it was a whole new level of transparency. It was exhausting, like canvassing a day on top of school. I was traveling a lot over the summer, and you know, having to juggle 6 jobs in freshman year and running my nonprofits and also trying to run for office because I genuinely believed in why I was running, and my motives were constantly questioned. And I think that there were like to get a whole new level of hate, experiencing that for my race, for my motives, for my background, for what I look like any self that I didn't even think to scrutinize. And so when I learned about the APEX national training, I looked into it not because I'm Asian at all, but I looked into it because I was like, I just need to meet more candidates. Like, I need to meet more people who are running for office and putting themselves out there and might be experiencing the same sort of comments, just because I wanted to be able to speak to people,
you know, who are going through similar things. Oh, sorry. Before you had run, did you even think that you would get those type of comments from the public?
No. I knew I would get comments for being a young person, like a 19-year-old. But I didn't, I think talking about race was a whole, like, I didn't even know that I, like, so when I ran, I found out a few months in that if elected, I would be the first Asian American female ever elected in the city's history. But I didn't know that going into it, you know? And so the conversation around race was very surprising to me, because it was something that played more into the reactions I got on a local and national level than I ever thought. You know, a lot of the visceral racism didn't come from within Cambridge. Like, if anything, the comments I would get from running in Cambridge was like people would say, oh, you're running for Leland Chung's spot, right? Because he's the one Asian American guy who wasn't running for re-election. And apparently there's only one Asian spot that needs to be filled.
Just one at a time. Right? One at a time.
Yeah. So it was kind of like, it was interesting because I would get those comments or like people would open the door. And I remember someone saying like, oh yeah, we need some more Oriental people like in politics. And I was like, yeah, that's not, yeah, like I don't think that's what you're supposed to say. Yeah. So, but I mean, it was something that people noticed. And I think for the first time, I was getting kind of called out by people to say, like, embrace your Asian identity. And I remember going to the APAC Gala and, like, Cory Booker standing up and being like, we need Asian politics. And seeing Grace Meng and Stephanie Chang from Florida get up and say, like, this is what it means to be an Asian American politics, right? And I just remember, like, tearing up and crying and afterwards in my hotel room being, like, so enlightened by the fact of, like, oh my gosh, like, I've never seen role models in politics, which is something I really care about, that like look like me, right? Mm-hmm. And I was sitting, the person I went with as a guest actually was with June Shi, and she's one of my mentors. I got connected with her through the Global Teen Leaders Program through the We Are Family Foundation, which I actually won because of my work with Period. But I remember I went with her, and she was like a speechwriter for Hillary Clinton and like very involved in the whole political world. And I remember talking to her being like, you should run for office, right? And just slowly kind of coming into this world where I was like, Asians are in politics? Like, Asians can be in politics? Like, people want Asians in politics? But then also realizing, like, I remember one of the statistics that just kept being repeated at this gala was like, you know, Asians are the fastest growing minority population in the U.S., but wholly underrepresented from the local to the federal level, right? And I had never heard that before. But it just prompted this whole reflection within me, because the summer before I had attended the Democratic National Convention, actually as a shadow of Wendy Davis, who's one of sort of my reproductive rights activist heroes. And I got to work with her for a little bit. And I remember watching like when they had all the AAPI people go up, representatives go up, and like not once did they say we need more Asian representation. But then I remember they had all the African American representatives go up, and there were like four times as many, and like all they could talk about was like, we need more like African Americans and Black Americans to Congress or elected to these seats, right? But the APAC Gala was the first time that I was seeing Asians who were elected officials on stage claiming that we needed more representation, right? It was just like a really new experience for me.
So for your, you know, you wrote this article, it's recently came out, and so you're still, according to you, pretty new on this journey of, I don't know if you want to call it Asian pride or what you want to call it, but
actually, oh, interesting story. When I was in high school, I was the president of my Asian pride club.
Really?
And me and my best friend, who's Asian American, started it. And we started it simply because we were like, we just want a space to like be with other Asian Americans and like try to be excited about, you know, being a minority here and sort of do the high school's first affinity club. The administration in my high school shut us down.
No way. Season.
They would not let us be called Asian Pride, because actually the person who ran a lot of the clubs told us, you can't have an Asian pride club, because if you had a white pride club, it would be inappropriate, right? And we just kept hearing that, and it actually took us finding, you know, teachers in the middle school and in other parts of the school to like help us and be like, no, it's not about the fact that like we can't have a white pride club, it's the fact that like minorities need to have these spaces because this racism still exists, right? And like, yeah, anyways, that's a tangent, but we called it Asian Pride Club, the acronym to be AP Club, sort of like on a play around the like stereotype of Asians doing a lot of APs.
I didn't even think about that, because when I was growing up in the, like when I was in high school in the 90s, Asian Pride, like Asian Pride, was like a big cultural thing. Like it was just like, oh my God, Asian Pride. And I didn't even think about that was like AP. Because we also had the biggest AP program, like, because I went to this, like, super Asian-heavy school. Why weren't we all making that joke? We missed it.
I know, AP club.
Okay, now, I mean, you're 19 years old, you know, so you're not, like, a kid, you know, and you're in college now and everything. What is it like for you at this beginning phase of your adulthood to now be reassessing your identity and like how you view yourself and I don't know, maybe this is a too broad of a question, but even, you know, in all the work that you're doing, like with period and these sorts of things, do you feel like your self-realization affects how you view your life moving forward?
I think that, you know, to be completely honest, I think I'm just starting my journey of exploring and embracing what it means to be Asian American, right? Like, I think if you were to ask me, like, what does it mean to be Asian American? My honest answer is I'm still figuring it out, you know? Like, I think I still struggle in these instances of, like, even getting ready, of being like, how can I come across as bold and outspoken, right? Sort of being scared that people are going to look at me and think I'll be quiet, you know? I think that it's something I'm still very much figuring out. And I think when I think about where my life is going to go, I think that there's a lot more room I have to grow in terms of realizing what it means to be Asian American. I honestly have no idea what I want to do with my life, nor do I have any big long-term career goals, but I'm having a lot of fun, like, exploring different options in different fields, right? So I'm writing a book right now. I just signed my first book deal with Simon & Schuster, and the first draft of my manuscript is due in a few days, and writing a manifesto for the menstrual movement, and it's coming out in fall 2018. So I'm kind of, like, honored and excited and nervous to be, like, an Asian American author, like, in the activist world. So I'm doing that and, like, doing a lot more entertainment and media stuff this year and continuing my work with period and a lot of, working with reproductive rights. So I'm excited to explore what it means to be Asian American in these different fields, for sure.
Sometimes I cringe when I look back at myself for all the things I did, like, to try to not be Asian. But at the same time, you know, it's one of those life things where you're like, hey, I wouldn't take it back because I grew from it in so many ways. And it gave me, like, a perspective that I don't maybe think would be, like, my perspective now wouldn't be as rich had I not gone through this really long phase of, like, self-hatred. Like, do you feel, I mean, you're in the beginning stages of your, like, own self-reflection, but do you kind of embrace who you used to be, or is there, like, a backlash, or is there, like, a, hey, that's how it was and I'm proud of that? How does it feel to reflect back?
Reflecting back on it, I think that I'm very much embracing it, because I think that I wouldn't be so reflective and interested and curious about what it means now if I hadn't gone through it, you know? And so I think I'm actually learning in a much deeper and impactful way now because of my past experiences. But I laugh at it now because I realize that it influenced so much of how I conducted myself. I just find it really funny. I don't know. I think that it's so interesting to look back at my life and hear your story too and the stories of others and realize, like, this is something that Asian Americans think about so much. Like, it influences the way we act, the way we dress, the way we talk, the way we, like, interact with people. Like, it's always on our minds, but somehow it's not discussed, right? And so I don't know. I think I'm really excited to, like, keep having these conversations.
That was Nadia Okamoto, founder and executive director of the nonprofit Period. You can learn more about them at period.org. Nadia is also the founder and spokesperson for E Pluribus, which you can find at eplur.org. You can find Nadia's piece on nextchart.com by searching for Until 3 months Ago, I Was Ashamed of Being Asian. A special thanks to Nadia for taking the time to share her story with us today, and a big thanks to Calisthetics of Glass Bottom Boat Productions for the music. You can find more of his music at dogmauno.com. That's spelled DoggmaUno.com.
Okay, y'all. So we're
here. Thank you, Nadia.
Yeah, thank you, Nadia.
And thank you, Jenna.
Yeah, thanks, Jenna. Yeah,
it was a fun interview. It was like, yeah, because she's 19 and I'm of the ripe age of 36. And just,
I know, what I'm hearing her bio. What am I accomplishing right now?
Just a real quick overview again of her bio. You should check out Nadia and all her work that she's doing. Nadia Okamoto, I'm just directly reading her bio here because it's it's just so much to list. Nadia Okamoto, who grew up in Portland, is a 19-year-old sophomore going to Harvard. She is the founder and executive director of Period, which you can find at period.org, an organization she founded at 16. She's also the co-founder and spokesperson of E Pluribus, which you can find at eplur.org. And as you heard in that in the interview, that she's also just turned in her manuscript there to Simon & Schuster. So, yeah. But, you know, it's like, it's interesting, even though, like, you know, yeah, she does have a lot of, you know, credits to her name.
And running for city council. And
running for city council. I did find it interesting to talk to somebody who is 19 and really reminded me of me, like, at 19 in many ways, where you're at that beginning journey of, like, understanding your identity and separating yourself from the things you were told who you should be in your youth versus actually having to defend who you are to yourself. And something I told her at the end of the interview, I was like, man, I would love to interview you in a decade. Can we set that up? Like, because I would just love to hear what has it been like since then, you know, and that also she is getting to go through this journey, and I'm hoping a kind of a different environment than like I did a decade ago, where there is more open talk. I mean, there's places like neckshark.com, like that didn't exist, you know, like a decade ago. So, okay, let's just go around. Reflections, anybody?
Wait, first of all, what is neckshark.com? Because I don't even know.
Okay, neckshark.com is a website that has a lot of opinion pieces published by young Asian Americans.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, all sorts of stuff on there.
Nice.
I related to a lot of her stories because she grew up in Portland. I grew up in Salem. And a lot of the stories about how people are very passive-aggressive about acknowledging and not acknowledging racism and your race are so true, because we're very passive-aggressive here in Oregon.
Well, I have a question for you. Since she, like, you know, she came from New York, and so she saw a difference because she was, like, 9 years old. But you have always grew up in Salem. So did you notice a lack of diversity then?
Not until I was older. When I was a child, it was normal for me. And so I was so used to seeing white faces.
Well, and then did you hear, like, when people were saying those passive-aggressive things, could you hear him as being otherizing at the time?
No. And actually, in elementary school, I got in a fight on the playground. And
what?
I can't imagine Tabitha in a fight.
I know. Imagine a chihuahua back in the corner.
Oh, my gosh. It's going to be fierce.
I was suspended for, like, 3 days. But
what?
Oh, my God.
Wow, we got to hear this.
Well, both of us got suspended for 3 days. Whoa. So it wasn't just...
I have
just,
a new respect for you, Tabitha.
Whoa, Tabitha. What happened?
Scrapping.
What happened?
It was this girl. I think her name was Tracy. We were friends. You know, it's the elementary school things. Like, you're my best friend one day, and then the next day, I hate you.
Right.
And I cannot remember who started the fight, but we did get in a fight. It resulted in someone getting pushed off of the monkey bars, I think. But anyways.
Monkey bars, the site of many...
many turf wars. Anyways, well, my white best friend at the time had to point out to me that Tracy called me the Yellow Ranger. On my race. I did not hear it at the time, and it wasn't until that was pointed out to me by my white best friend, by the way, that it's like, oh, I'm Asian, and I am different, and I'm viewed as different by my peers.
Yeah, I remember being called the Yellow Ranger. Because I wanted to be Trini, right? I love Trini, but I didn't want people limiting that. Like, I should just be Trini, because I was like, oh, I could be the Red Ranger. Don't you just call me the Yellow Ranger. I know what's going on there.
I like the Red Ranger, but only because red is my favorite color.
And that's why you should be. You should be able to identify with whoever you want to, just because it's like your favorite color.
Yeah, that was after my time. I didn't really, you know, I wasn't around when that Power Ranger stuff. My sister was into it. And I remember her telling me, she's like, yeah, they always tried to get me to be the Yellow Ranger, but I was like all about red or something.
Right,
it's
those little things that are like so innocent that you wouldn't ever, like, as a kid, think to go to the teacher and be like, they called me the Yellow Ranger, because you know it's just like a really passive comment. And those are like that trained behavior where everything becomes normalized, where you're like, oh, I'll accept this little comment. I'll accept this little comment. Because if you say something, then you're going to get suspended, apparently, from school.
Or they treat you like you're crazy.
Yeah, you're crazy. You're too sensitive.
Overreacting.
Yeah.
And when we were called into the principal's office, like my best friend didn't mention this to the principal. And maybe because she was hoping I would say something, but I never said something because I didn't recognize that at the time. But I like to think that both of us getting in school suspension was also for her racial slur against me.
I like that a little bit, yeah. Even if she didn't know. There you go. Kanan, do you have any kind of thoughts after hearing that?
I don't know. I'm remembering a lot of like offhanded comments about Asianness that I received when I was growing up in like elementary school and middle school. Both of those experiences were kind of like wrapped up in one because they were the same school for me. Mm. But yeah, just some of my like close friends who were all white because there were I had maybe like one or two Asian male identified friends growing up, and like outside of family, outside of like my temple community, which was like my primary connection to like Asianness and like Buddhism and that part of my identity. Aside from that, at school, like playing on soccer teams, all of that, I had mostly white friends, and all my like male identified friends would say things that were really messed up in hindsight. They would say like, they were just really fond of saying things like Asian invasion or like the Asian persuasion, and like, you know, like implying that I should have like tastes in like Asian women, and like all of these like really problematic normative things that are like really violent. And I was like, I don't understand why you're saying these things, but I also didn't at the time feel like any sort of power to be like, hey, shut up. That's a dumb thing to say. Like, it also like is incredibly hurtful.
Yeah. And they're like, do you think that those things contributed to a feeling of being ashamed? I don't know. Like, would you use that word ashamed at all?
Yeah, definitely.
To describe yourself?
I think that's like the emotion that was there. It was just like, why are you drawing attention to this? And mm-hmm. because it was being drawn attention to in like a way that, I was feeling like ridiculed, I wanted the attention to be like off of it. And mm-hmm. so also like having my mom being Japanese, 100% Japanese, became a complicated thing for me, I think, because like when I would have friends over for the first time at my house, sometimes they wouldn't realize. I was just telling y'all before the show, I had a basketball coach who was like, who like saw me get picked up by my mom like after basketball practice and was like, oh, your mom's Asian. I have an Asian girlfriend or something like that. And I was like, what am I supposed to say to that?
Gross.
Yeah. That's really gross.
Thanks. Yeah.
You know, but the power dynamic is there. And then that's the normalization of just like, okay, well, I'm going to normalize my shame or my anger or whatever reaction you have to it, because you're not supposed to, you know, and like, you're not supposed to react. And then I know for myself, at least, where I identify with like the shame is that I'd be mad at other people for saying things like that. But the resolution in my head was often like, man, if I was just white, this would be so much easier. Because I think I was a lot like Nadia, where I wasn't like, oh my God, I hate, you know, like Asian people. I mean, like, you know, we're all kind of, I mean, I was surprised to hear like, what, you started your Asian Pride Club, but yet you only realized that you were ashamed of being Asian like 3 years later, where it's just like really, really complicated because you don't maybe fully hate yourself, you accept yourself, but there's like all these like other factors that make you just go like, man, if I just was white, then I'd have big eyes and then I wouldn't have to deal with the harassment, right? Like, you might not hate your eyes, but you don't want to have to deal with the harassment that like comes with it. And I think for me, that was like a lot of stuff was just like, so when I was in high school, like I was one of those people who took a lot of pride in calling myself a Twinkie or a banana. I think I used the word Twinkie a lot more, though, because I thought banana was like kind of like, I don't know, it just seemed gross. And Twinkies were like around forever. And that way I could be indestructible and be a Twinkie forever. Oh, my God. You know, but it was...
Zombieland proves that.
Yeah, I don't think I heard about the term coconut for brown on the outside, white on the inside.
Oh, really?
Until like much later when I was like in college and I'd already kind of like been a little bit further along in this whole identity thing.
Oh, that's such a cringy.
It's so weird.
Cringy term, right? But like you take, yeah. can take so much pride in that, you know, like having that identity of like, because I was, it wasn't as though I was totally hiding it. I knew I couldn't like plastic surgery my face to hide the fact that I was Asian. I didn't want to hide it, but I wanted to be seen in this very Japanese American mentality that grosses me out now, where I'm like, look how accomplished I am at assimilation. Oh my gosh, I've overcome all that stuff that those stupid immigrants haven't figured out yet. And oh, look at me, like I don't need to have Asian pride because like I speak perfect English. Like I had so much pride over my perfect California accent and stuff like that. It's just like,
yeah, you know? It's like I'm not one of those fob types.
Yeah,
you know,
and
with
I was
the
just,
heavy accent.
I thought and I was the idealized Asian American. I was mm-hmm. like, this is what you should all want to be. Like, you can look like this, but you should be able to sound white and dress white, and you don't need to only have Asian. Oh, now I'm just like 16-year-old Jonna. Stop it.
So what's a fob type?
I only heard that term later, right? And that's fresh off the boat. Yeah. And it's like, you don't want to be like a recent immigrant or sometimes like refugee type of Asian, you know, low socioeconomic kind of thing. Yeah. And I remember that being very stigmatized. Yeah. And I had several, like my few other Asian friends and I from grade school had all just sort of like dropped off from each other. Nothing like violently, you know, like kind of falling out, but like it was definitely isolating.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and I think it's like, oh, look how popular you are. but I think it's really kind of sad about the whole, you know, recent immigrant thing is that, I don't know about you guys, but I knew a lot of immigrants who had come. They had, especially, we had a lot of people who had recently come from, like, China. And I didn't look necessarily down on them individually, like when we were one-on-one. I often like, oh guys, I'm so savory when I'm back then, but I was like, oh, I felt bad for them because people were like bullying them and ridiculing them, and I felt some affinity to them because I was Asian too, but I also wanted to really make sure everybody knew that like I wasn't like them, right? Like I spoke the English, right? Because they would always, that's the kind of stuff you would hear. It's like, oh, well, they don't speak the English and stuff like that. And I was just like, no, I'm really cool. Like, look at me, you know? And just like Nadia was saying, it's like, I tried to make sure that dressing the part, like, oh, I don't dress conservatively. I don't, you know, I don't look like this. I don't look like that. And just like all these things to make sure to distinguish me from that. And for me in high school, it was about Weezer. That was like super white to me. It was like, because that's what.
The band?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the band. That's like when in the 90s, that's what cool Asian, non-Asians did, the Twinkies did. Like we were either skaters. Oh, you're super into Weezer.
But there was a slight undercurrent of Asian fetishization in Weezer. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
He has that song to the half Japanese girl. Like, there's, he calls his second album Pinkerton, which is based on that Madame Butterfly play. You know, it's like different layers of problematicness.
Yeah. And then, like, part of that was also like me realizing that. And then acting totally cool about it because
you're evolved, right? Yeah, you're like, it doesn't bother me.
Yeah, it doesn't bother me. Yeah, and then like, because, you know, I'm also like, at the time, fetishizing like half Asian people because I'm like hating on myself and thinking that half Asian people are like the ultimate in beauty and stuff like that. Yeah. So I'm like, oh my God, Weezer knows. They know. Oh my gosh. You know, it's just, it's cringy now.
It's layers.
It's so many layers.
Yeah.
I don't know, did anybody ever like, do anything like that, like besides just me, like to change, kind of like change your appearance? I remember like I dyed my hair purple for a while because I was apparently one of those Asians with a hair streak because I was going to be cool, and like that made me look less Asian because Asians at the time were only doing the brown, orange, blonde thing, and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be like a punk and dye my hair purple because I'm so white.
I was really excited when my optometrist told me I could finally start wearing contacts. So if you ever meet me, I've worn glasses my whole life, and I've hated wearing glasses. I'm fine now with it. But when I was a kid, I hated wearing glasses because, like, Asians are associated with being nerds, good at math and science, and I did not want to be associated with that. But I couldn't wear contacts as a kid because your eyes are still growing, but then my optometrist said in middle school, you can start wearing contacts now if you'd like. And I was like, yes. And so I asked I begged my parents to please get me contacts, and they did. And I'd spend a half hour every morning wrangling those contacts in my eyes. And then every Sunday evening, I put it in the enzyme thing, and And as an adult, I was like, oh my gosh, that is such a huge hassle. Glasses are so much easier.
Was there a feeling of disappointment, though, then when it, like, did that play on the identity thing at all when you went back to the glasses? Or was it just like,
it was whatever? It was more of a convenience thing and, like, definitely an embracement of my Asian-ness. And that I am too lazy for this. And
I might as well just accept the fact that I'm Asian.
Yeah.
Like, wow. Yeah. Like, what's other people have moments of that sort of thing, like little moments where you find like, oh, I just got to embrace myself. Because I know I definitely didn't have like a moment where I was like, yes, oh, now I will hug myself and realize this, right? It's like, it's a journey, like so much of identity. So anybody got stories about like little moments?
Well, yeah, I have this thing, this observation that's coming to me right now of like, in my experience and kind of like what I see other people who are vaguely Asian or very Asian, some variation of Asian.
Oh, no. Oh, no. You're doing it. You're
sorry.
Doing it. No.
Sorry,
you're
going
to have to use
myself.
That one again on Pacific Islander, the variation.
Variation. go through this like process of distancing ourselves from Asianness to like try to like acquire or attain like whiteness. And then at some
point, white approximation.
White mm-hmm. approximation, or just like
scooting on over.
Like avoiding the things that identify us as other so we can blend in and not draw attention to ourselves, not be ostracized, whatever that experience is. It's violent, it's bad. But we've all figured out ways of doing that to get where we are. And then we come back to this point where we're like, oh, we are who we are and that's good and everything. But I think we lose stuff in that process. Oh, yeah. You know, like there's like there are certain like things that have to do with like culture, identity and class. Like mm-hmm. I think still in this room, like there's the only reason like we can be like talking about this and like have some sort of like grasp on it is because like we have all been exposed to education and we have some sort of understanding of like the historical process that has brought us to this moment. And I think that's like a really interesting thing, a really important thing, because if the education piece and like the class piece of like having class mobility, having the ability to like assimilate and be accepted on the basis of like economic status is really yeah. interesting too. And I'm wondering like if like what that process is for what that's been for some of you and like what maybe you sense you've like lost touch with in that process.
Well, I'll definitely say that like, I mean, Japanese Americans, I know we talked about it before on the show, like they have, I think we have a weird place in America. We've been here for a while and we, after World War II, you know, we always talk about how Japanese Americans like really set up the model minority, right? And so, I mean, once again, I'm sorry, every time we mention it, we're just like, oh God, Japanese America, we're so sorry that we set up the model minority and everything that goes with that, with the idea that like, yes, assimilation is the key to not being oppressed, right?
And also keeping your head down, not saying anything.
Yeah, and that's part of the assimilation process. Like, unfortunately, it intersects with Japanese culture where it's like, that's just also Japanese culture, is to keep your head down and, you know, to just assimilate into whatever culture you're in. And so it's very convenient in that sort of way where whiteness can just be like, hey, people who like assimilate, like, let's just force this upon you. But I feel like, you know, it's, as you're saying, like, it's so much about the education component to try to walk that back. Like, it's going to take a lot to walk back the model minority. We're going to be fighting that for many more generations. And I think it's, like, so important for people to recognize that that's happening at all, right? Because it's privilege to be able to recognize that at all and to be able to have the choice to be like, well, I'm not going to assimilate, right? Because if you're a recent immigrant, like, you better, right? You're not going to make
survival.
It economically, right?
Yeah.
That's how the American system is set up, right? It's mm-hmm. about assimilation. And so the fact that I know, like, one thing I've tried to do my whole life is, like, take Japanese school classes, like, or Japanese language classes, because that's been lost over the generations. Part of Japanese America was about stopping the speaking of our language, right?
Right.
But the fact that I feel like I can go back and try to take language classes and try to reclaim that just shows, I feel like, what a position of privilege I am in, that I'm like, oh, I don't risk being seen as another, right, that I can like take those classes like as a privilege. I mean, it's its own other thing. We can talk about a whole other thing about what it is about language, but to me, that's one example.
Sure. Yeah, totally. I feel like having, like growing up with a male identity and all those pressures that come with it, I felt this like need to like be a non-threatening presence to male whiteness, which was really interesting because like male whiteness is so like fixated around power, obviously. And I feel like the Asian, all the stereotypes, all the like the harmful and garbage expectations around like Asian male and masculine presentation is like so centered around like tropes, so centered around like being like the non-threatening funny one or the like diminutive like nerdy one, you know. And I felt like I had a very complex and confusing relationship with masculinity growing up because there was just like there were weird barriers there where if I felt like I transgressed, then like white male people in the vicinity would start to like, you know, figuratively like flex and like to take up more space.
I definitely relate to that. It seems like the culture of sort of fetishization of Asian women and emasculation of Asian men is so like ingrained that like any attempt to like step out of those bounds, those pre-constructed sort of that are policed a lot of times by whiteness and, you know, white people, but also by ourselves, right? That the only sort of some of the only attempts to sort of find a positive third way are like kind of overcompensating, like, you know, Eddie Huang and like Fresh Off the Boat and all that, like AAVE kind of like talking, you know, trying to be more black than black people or something like that. It's just very weird. There's no clear path.
Yeah. And then it's just anti-blackness, like, well, we could get into that forever too. Yeah it's
that's
just
a whole nother episode.
it's so complex of just how, I mean, it's that whole, right, like divide and conquer thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though it's like people co-opting and misappropriating and stuff, it's part of the divide and conquer strategy of like white supremacy. And it's just, so it's just like, hey, let's just make sure that there is no vehicle for reclamation of identity or for, you know, Asian masculinity even to ever really be reclaimed. It's interesting to see that kind of movement happening slowly in Asian America, you know, or how that's moving right now, because it's always a discussion. So, okay, so what we need to do in our last few minutes here, can we talk about, because we can talk about, oh my gosh, how much it just was traumatizing and all these things, but I want to know hopeful things from people. How do you feel now about your Asian identity? Are you still on a journey, which probably we will always be on a journey, but where you feel like you're on that journey compared to say like when you were 19 and you're Nadia's age, and like what are you still doing to try to embrace and reclaim that?
I feel like it's important for me in my journey to be like thinking about race and identity by talking about anti-blackness and by talking about blackness as the reason that whiteness exists, and just thinking about it and working through anti-blackness as it comes up in our lives, because I think it's still like such an uncomfortable topic for people to engage with. And I think like Asian folks do have the ability to make a very big impact in like initiating that conversation, because we don't have access to whiteness, but we're also way like infinitely in ways that we can't even really describe, that I can't describe at least, like benefiting from not having that like legacy of just destructive hate around the color of our skin and our like appearance. So that's really interesting. Also, like one thing that like blew my mind was or that's been like blowing my mind over like a process, is thinking about like white supremacy in Japanese culture and how like Japan was like one of the first Asian countries that like really got like whitewashed in a huge way, and how that informed the way that they invaded in the 20th century and like had this like really that gross pedigree that we heard from Nadia about like Japanese-ness is less dirty than the Chinese-ness, and mm-hmm. you need to like wash the Chinese-ness away. Like, that to me just seems like some really, really nasty and insidious self-hatred that's just like been festering there.
Well, and then you see that extend into who we are today. As you don't say, as Japanese Americans here in this country, we're just extending that, right? Like our families came over and we're like, oh yes, let's just continue this westernization, quote unquote westernization, and like, because that's what's respectful in the world, you know, that's how you can be respected on the world stage, is like, get rid of that Asianness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sort of thing. Okay, but gotta ask you, where are you on your journey of personally, like, your feeling of ashamed or Asian pride?
Me personally, I still have to work through a lot of shame, I think. And I think it would be good to like revisit some of those conversations with people I've lost touch with and be like, hey, remember when you said that messed up thing to me? Like, or remember that time we were like, I have this thing that came to me during, like, while we were sitting here, like, I was playing a show and the person in my band was like, this one's for Kanan's sister. And oh, we played a cover of that Japanese, of the Weezer song.
No!
And like, it like came back to me and I was like, oh, that really hurts.
So problematic.
And I was so angry that whole song. I like kind of wanted to just like get off the drums and just not even...
Oh, you're playing?
I was playing. I had to play through that song.
Oh my God, I would have
thrown your sticks into the crowd.
Yeah, or just like, let's increase the tempo by tenfold to get this over and done with.
Yeah.
But that's, wow. Yeah, so I'm hearing sort of like, I know we got to wrap it up here. We only have a couple minutes left. But yeah, not just so much of like thinking, oh wow, those are the things that happened to me, but actually taking the time to finally... have a voice about it and to confront those things that, you know, the quiet, keep your head down, like, attitude mm-hmm. we've all been taught. It's like, well, part of it is learning how to speak up and be like, wow, that was painful and traumatizing. And dude, no.
Yeah.
Just not okay.
So not okay.
Tabitha,
did you have a talk with your bandmate afterwards?
Well, that's what he's saying. He
needs to. It's unresolved. Yeah.
So Tabitha, where
I think we need to call him on one of the future shows.
Oh my God.
I'd like to talk to him.
Ooh. Live call.
Reminds me of some of my old friends.
I'm in a place where I feel very comfortable with my Chinese identity. I would like to take Chinese language classes, but I am working my way through the journey to the West, and I'm trying to learn more about Chinese holidays other than New Year's and celebrating those.
Okay. Jay, what about you?
I don't know. I don't think it's a binary. I think we're all somewhere in the middle, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like I'm better than I was a year ago. And yeah, God forbid if I should ever like talk to a teenage Jake and, you know, Time Machine or something, I'd slap some sense into that guy. But yeah, I'm thinking about taking some of the, I've been taking off and on some of the Filipino language classes put on by those Gabriella folks. Thanks. And it's been good.
It's a journey. It's a journey, y'all. It's a journey. Well, thanks for tuning in to another Pacific Underground. We'll be back again
in a week.
Oh my
In goodness. A week. Wow. That's amazing. Okay.
At 9 a.m.
We're so ready for that show.
We'll talk to you then.